Welcome to another edition of Bisexual Brunch with Lewis Oakley, Nikki Hodgson and Ashley Byrne.
If nobody was told what you were meant to do, if there weren't any rules, we would be living in a totally different format.
We as journalists and activists have always found it very difficult to find people who will openly talk about being bisexual.
Just don't think there are enough bi perspectives on bi issues.
I feel like we've got to talk about it because we're really comfortable doing that.
It can be really intimidating. Bisexuality is not really understood because people have biphobic tendencies.
And the second you mention bisexual, just their ears pick up.
Oh, well, you're still confused, right? No, I'm not confused.
I've always found myself at the mercy of gay and straight advice.
You can have a bit of a competition to see who's the better bisexual bruncher.
This is Bisexual Brunch.
So then, we're in September now, and September's supposed to be quite a special month for bisexual people because it's Bi Visibility, Bi Awareness Day on the 23rd of September, is it, or something? And then I keep hearing things like it's Bi Pride Month or Bi Visibility Month or something. But it all seems a bit unclear to me. And if I'm being honest, I know this day, Bi Visibility Day, has been going on for about 21 years, I think, if I remember rightly, or 20 years. But it never really touches me. Even when I wasn't doing anything, you know, active-wise in terms of bisexuality, in terms of journalism or activism or anything, I never heard of it really. So I know you're doing your own little bit, Lewis, aren't you? But why haven't we heard about it really? Why does nobody really know it exists?
You know what? It's a tricky one. I get what you're saying. You know, it's not as massive as some of the other weeks or months that are celebrated. I personally find it helpful because it's a time where you can really hold people to account. You can say, well, you say you're an LGBT organization. It's Bi Visibility Month. What are you doing? Or it's a really good way for me to be able to say, you know, it's Bi Visibility Day coming up. I've got this idea for an article that I think would really work. You kind of take some of the work off them a little bit. So it is good if you've got a way to try and get that voice out there, and if you've got something to say, it's good from that perspective. As far as, you know, does it touch every bisexual? No, it doesn't. And yeah, there is a bit of confusion about, because it did start, as you say, I think it's 22 years ago now, a Bi Visibility Day. Now that seems to have been extended to the whole month of September. So that, you know, I think we're growing. We'll decide on what we're going to call it eventually. Bi Pride Month, Bi Visibility Month, Bi Month, who knows? But I personally find it quite useful. And it's just a time where we can kind of say, right, we said we were going to talk about this in September, you promised. That's kind of my take on it.
I always have to remind myself, because it's my birthday at the beginning of September, and then I'm like, there's always something else important that I need to remember, and it's always Bi Visibility Day, but I never really remember it. And I think it's been around for longer than I've been bi, but yet I've still never really used it properly. I find other holidays that are about the LGBTQI community more useful in general, even though we all know that we don't often get the representation we deserve at those times, because I find that more people are thinking, oh, I've got to get a piece in about X. And I have struggled in the past to get people to take September seriously, but that doesn't mean that they won't this year. I feel like we've had a good year for being bi, and there's been lots of people in the public eye, lots of people in the media talking about it. So I suspect there'll be more in the news this time.
Now, Lewis, you're doing your little bit, aren't you? You're putting up posters and things. Have you done this before? Tell us all about it. What is it exactly?
Stickers. So, I mean, one of the things I've always said is that, you know, if I walk down the street past someone, no one would know that I'm bisexual, especially if I'm holding my girlfriend's hand. And the same for if you're bisexual and you're single, the same for if you're bisexual and holding your boyfriend's hand. You know, that no one ever looks and is like, oh, there's a bisexual. So I kind of was like, there's got to be something we can do with that. And I kind of came up with this idea of like little stickers. And the sticker just says, a bisexual was here. Yes, we exist. And I think it's quite cute that bisexual people can go around and just kind of put those places and just, you know, while someone's sitting on the tube and sees the sticker or wherever they are and just is like, oh, yeah, bisexual people, and just get them thinking. Because I do worry sometimes about the echo chamber. I think, you know, with the work I do, I think I get through to bisexual people, closet bisexual people, which is great. But you never really reach out to those people that maybe aren't thinking about LGBT people. Not that they're anti it, they're just not thinking about it. They've got other stuff to do. I think it's just a little reminder. It's not political, it's not lecturing, it's not anything. It's just like, yeah, we're here. It's really cute. And you know what? It's been a really weird experience doing it. Because partly I'm like, is this legal? Can I put this on Big Ben? So there's that element of like, am I going to get arrested for this? It's just a sticker. It'll come off. Surely they're not going to find me, right? But then there's this really weird part of me who, can you believe it? Someone that, you know, parades around in their underwear, bisexual on their chest, gets a little nervous. Like, I'm putting this sticker on. I'm like, oh, the person behind me is going to be like, what's he doing? He's putting a sticker on. Oh, he's bisexual. And you know where it's like, you know, usually you can kind of control who knows that you're bisexual because you tell them. And it's kind of like, I'm putting this here and then I'm going to take a picture of it. And, that you know, there's the general public around and how are they going to react? And honestly, it's a bit of a weird feeling. But I am going to post you guys a sheet each this week. So then if anyone ever does see the campaign is like, you can't do this, we're going to find you. I'm going to be like, oh, well, who knows who it was? I've sent them out to other people. Plausible deniability.
I think that's excellent. To be honest, most people who know me think it's amazing that I've never been arrested for anything. So the idea that I might stick a sticker somewhere and that's what I get done for thrills me. So I'm well up for it. Well up for it.
Yeah. Well, they'll be coming in the post to you this week.
Have you actually had any reactions when you've done it? Have people actually spotted you doing it, Lewis, and you've said anything to you or anything like that?
No, because I've been so covert and I don't know what it is. Like, I literally... I know, it's so bizarre and it's a bit hypocritical because I'm obviously always here like, you know, it's great to be bi, but then it's come to it where you're just out there. Just, I don't know whether it's I'm out of practice with coming out or whatever it is. It's just like, it honestly has been a bit like, and I think it's the double thing. It's like, is someone going to be like, you're bisexual or you're fine? But I do think it's a really great way. And I think it's one of those things, a lot of people have commented online, like, where can we get them? So maybe it's the start of an Etsy store. I don't know. Oh. I'm running out of them as it goes. But I think it's a really great thing. And obviously, where you can do it with the monuments, because we, you know, I'm in London. So it's really great to be able to have Big Ben in the background or have Nelson's column or whatever it is and be like, you know, we're here, we're everywhere. And, you know, obviously it's a great from a social media perspective, but I honestly, genuinely, and the concept came from it, of just putting these places where people will see it and be like, oh yeah, like I put one the other day on an ATM machine. So people are going to go there, putting in their PIN, and they're going to see that little sticker and be like, oh, okay. And I just, yeah, I've just been trying to put it places where I put some in men's urinals as well. So, you know, they can have a little bi visibility while they have a wee.
I think you should put your phone number on it as well. Because
my phone number? I'm not into that.
No, but, or we should get a burner phone and we should just put the number on of the burner phone and see what weird messages and texts and phone calls we get. Do we get hate phone calls? Do we get people trying to crack onto us? Is it like a secret club? I don't know. I think we should have a bi phone that we carry, that we share between us.
Like the bat phone.
We could man it, exactly, like the bat phone. We could just man it for a day each and see what happens.
Maybe we should do it.
Yeah, it'd be a good idea.
But are you guys going to do it, like, Ash, you're in Manchester, can you decorate Manchester for us with some pictures?
I will definitely do it as well. I'll go to all the political, maybe I'll go to Parliament.
He's going to go to the police station and put it on to tempt fate.
No, I do know a few MPs and they let me into Portcullis House sometimes if I've got a coffee with one of them. So I'm quite tempted to go stickering in Portcullis House.
Oh, yeah, do that.
Dangerous.
This would be great, guys. I have put a little hashtag on it, which is bivisible. So I'm waiting for people to kind of tweet bivisible.
Excellent.
But yeah, I like the idea of the burner phone.
And can we, I mean, people are listening to us all over the world. So if anybody in Canada or America, Australia, Africa, wherever wants these posters, they could... That you could send them some as well, yeah?
I can try. Yeah. I don't have many left. I'm going to get some more printed. And you know what? Maybe I might do an Etsy store. I just can't, you know, with me, I'm just like, I can't be bothered like to set it up. Like, surely it's like, do I have to pay tax on that? I don't understand. Oh,
No. But, I'm sure there's an easier way we can do it. Well, we'll figure it out.
What's interesting about what you say, though, Lewis, you were saying earlier on about... again, about the whole thing of us having an echo chamber, and that the whole thing about Bi Visibility Day tends to be people talking to each other who know about being bi, and you know, everyone's sort of comfortable, and it's a little club in a way. What's been interesting about the doing Bisexual Brunch so far is that people are, you know, more and more people are starting to contact us and say, you know, they're in the closet, they're not open about stuff, that kind of thing. And I just want to use this opportunity to encourage more people to get in touch with us, you know, to contact us on Twitter, to contact the show, and we can at some point, you know, hopefully get in touch with you. We'd like to get some of you on air to talk to us. We can do things which disguise your voice or change your names or whatever. But we really do want to, don't we, guys, reach out to people who are bisexual but find it very difficult to open up about that, because that's what we're here for, really.
Yeah, God, so much. If we can help anyone, that's our prerogative, isn't it, really? So please do get in touch with us. We'd love it.
You're listening to Bisexual Brunch.
Now then, we're joined on the line from Bonn by Eric Wade. Eric Wade is a researcher who's been researching, Dr. Eric Wade, in fact, has been researching sexuality, LGBT sexuality in the medieval period. And it follows on quite well, this, from our feature last week, where we were talking about Shakespeare being bisexual. Eric, welcome to Bisexual Brunch. Start off then by telling us a little bit about the background, about the research that you've done, and then we'll jump in and start challenging about bisexuality. Tell us more.
Most of my research is focused on just questions of sort of sexuality and identity, really, in the first millennium in England. So, I mean, we're talking about like the earliest surviving texts in sort of English literature and history. So I work a lot with like the history of the church and LGBT issues. So, which obviously is a kind of a fraught, complicated history, but so my primary research concerns sort of how it is that the church thought about LGBT people, or people we would now call LGBTQ. Were there instances where we see sort of visibility where we might not expect it, that sort of thing.
How long have you been doing this? Is this something that's been a topic that you've been researching for a long time?
Yeah, I've been working on it for a few years now.
I mean, we'll talk about the bisexual side of things in a moment, but has it been easy to, well, two things, has it been easy to port to do this? And secondly, how easy is it to find out things from that period?
I've been very, very lucky in that I've had incredible support from people within the field, and that's different than I think it used to be if I'd been doing this work, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. But it is really difficult to find evidence. And part of that is obviously because this is a period where it was very, like, people who had sex with the same sex didn't talk about it a lot, or it was often frowned upon. The church had very, very strict anti-sodomy laws. So part of it is, like, it's a period where a lot of that stuff, a lot of that is underground, and it's just hard to find evidence. But the other part of it is that for really over 100 years, historians have really actively suppressed this sort of thing. And they haven't been interested in talking about it. They haven't, or when they talk about it, they kind of dismiss it as not really relevant. It's not really part of medieval history. It must have only been a tiny minority of people. And so you find all of these instances where somebody will do a translation of a medieval text, and they will cut out parts that seem queer to them. Or they'll translate them, or they'll alter them in certain ways, or they'll translate all of it into English except the part that seems to be about, say, men having sex with each other, and then they'll leave that part in Latin. So part of this is also just sort of fighting back against this kind of long-standing institutional, like, academic desire to kind of erase what we would now call LGBT identity from history, from the sources.
And I gather that issue is magnified when it comes to bisexuality, because there are lesbian and gay historians who will be happy to celebrate lesbian and gay history, but some of them might not be happy about celebrating bisexual history.
Right. I mean, of course. And most of the work that's been done has been done by historians who identify as gay men. And so a lot of the history of women's sexuality has really been sidelined in a lot of ways, and a lot of history that hasn't fit into this sort of neat little box for gay historians has been kind of sidelined. And you see this also with trans identity, for example. There are lots of stories of sort of people who are, say, assigned female at birth, and then they live these lives as men. And they have really complex sexual relationships with other people sometimes. And that has been kind of flattened by a lot of gay historians who just want to read that as evidence of gayness and who don't really want to think about sort of trans identity or anything like that. So we're still at a period, I think, where there is just a lot of work to be done uncovering identities outside of really sort of like very basic gay male identities.
Okay, well, we'll hone in a moment. Nikki and Lewis, I know, have got questions. Hone in a moment on some of the stuff that you found out, possibly, which, you know, shows that people were having, you know, sexual relations with men and women and, you know, the genders in the medieval times. But just tell us some of the highlights of what you've discovered anyway, some of the stuff that has been making the headlines around the research that you've done.
Right, so I have to emphasize, this is not stuff I've discovered. This is part of the issue, right? This is stuff that we have kind of known about for a couple hundred years. So I recently made some headlines because I posted on Twitter, basically, about this really obscure story, this old Irish story about what one might call queer medieval women. And it's a story that we've known about for a really long time, and that scholars of Irish literature have written about before, but it's become kind of this open secret in the field. And it's something that people don't really talk about. And so that's part of the issue, right? A lot of this is not like discovering new texts. It's not like I am, you know, like I'm in a library and I discovered some hidden manuscript behind a wall or something that nobody's seen. These texts are all there. And somebody will draw attention to them and a few people comment on it, and then it goes silent again. So this is something that this story in particular is one that has been sort of widely, I think some people have known about, but there hasn't been much discussion of it. So
when I say discovery, in essence, you are discovering it for the rest of us, in the sense that people haven't talked about it for a long time. So you're at least raising awareness of what was going on. Nikki,
right,
Lewis,
exactly.
Have you got anything to say?
Yeah, so I'm so interested by this, Eric, because I studied medieval literature as part of my degree many years ago and was really interested in ecclesiastical doings and poetry about Christ as the ultimate lover and all that kind of stuff that
yes.
went on. And I was wondering, you know, that people talk about in the monasteries and the convents about, you know, there's the famous myth of Abelard and Eloise, the
yes.
monk and the nun that get together. So are there cases of Abelard and Eloise and Eloise?
Oh yes, of course. There's loads of instances. There's we have these gorgeous love letters written, we think, between two nuns, for example, from 12th century Germany, that are and they're incredibly poetic, they're incredibly erotic. One letter talks about how it is written to this other woman, where she talks about how she misses the other woman caressing her breasts and all of this kind of stuff. And we have a lot of evidence for that. And we have monks writing these incredibly passionate letters back and forth. And of course, we have so many monks who get in trouble for having sex with other monks. Mm-hmm. And massive, massive evidence for nuns having sex with other nuns all the time, or having sex with women in the community. And there's lots of these kinds of stories, but a lot of them, again, are kind of slip between the cracks.
That's so interesting. Do you think that's because there's been a kind of, I don't know, maybe an 18th or a 19th century attempt to censor the past? I mean, do you think
yes.
that, yeah, so do you think that they were more free,
yes.
free perhaps at the time to talk about these things, and it's kind of a later censorship?
Yeah, I mean, this is, so one of the things that I work on specifically are basically these kind of manuals for confessors. So when you went to confession, the priest, the way that it used to work was the priest, it wasn't that the priest said, oh, have you sinned? What are your sins? The priest read from a list. And the priest was like, have you done this? Have you done this? Have you done this? And we have those lists. And so they, for a while, really before, say, the 1200s, the priest would seemingly get people together, would get the person who was confessing in and say, have you had sex, if you're a man, have you had sex with another man? How did you do it? Did you have sex between the thighs? Did you have anal sex? Did you masturbate each other? And they would ask all of these same questions of women. And then at a certain point, there was this anxiety by the church. They're like, oh, maybe we're giving people ideas by like listing all of these possible sins that they could be doing. But the weird part about it is that it's not until the Victorian period, I mean, really starting in the period of Shakespeare, but the Victorian period in particular, where those texts start to get censored by scholars. And it's weird that we have scholarship that is much more conservative than the medieval texts, which are pretty open. They're like, okay, do you frequently have anal sex with other men? Okay, then you should do this many years of penance. Do you do this? Like, are you two nuns and you use some sort of dildo? Okay, then it's this many years of penance. And then later on, right, then you get Victorian and 20th century scholars who are like, okay, we can't talk about that. We can't publish those texts. They have to really be hidden.
That is so fascinating. I like the idea as well that in medieval times, people did a kind of calculation. Well, I think this person is worth this much penance and I'm going to have sex with them anyway. Do you think people thought like that?
It's hard to say. I mean, that's what the church is accused of later in the Reformation, right?
Yeah.
Because of indulgences. They're like, oh, well, if you're rich, you can just buy your way into heaven. That's what the Catholic Church is trying to say. It's hard to say if that's what people did with penance. I mean, you can certainly imagine it. Or you can imagine people being like, oh, right, like, masturbation isn't that serious of a sin. I'll just have to, you know, sort of bread and water for 20 days or whatever. But it's not like I'm doing one of the big sins.
Got it.
So what stories have we got? What evidence is there that people were having sex with different genders, as it were, in that period? I gather there is some talk about people comparing sex with different genders, isn't there, and things like that. Tell us a bit about that, if you can.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the 12th century, for example, there's a very famous debate poem that basically has a young man and a young woman debate about what kind of love is better, the love of men who love men or men who love women. And the poem was really popular, and it was translated all over Europe. So the weird part about it is that the poem starts because the young man and the young woman are engaged to be married, but then the young man is very passive and he doesn't act, quote unquote, like a man is supposed to. But there isn't this sense that he's unwilling to have sex with her. He just wants to be the one to be penetrated, basically. And the poem actually ends up with the two of them getting married. So there is this sense to some extent that like there aren't these kind of static identities that you might necessarily have nowadays. I mean, there are all of these instances where you see people who are very clearly only having sex with one gender, but there's lots of instances where we see evidence that people may have taken more than one lover, or that it was understood that, for example, if you were a woman, you might have sex with your husband, but you might also have sex with other women. The story that I got into the headlines with recently is this, again, this Irish story where a woman brings her baby to this very famous Irish king, and she says, I don't know where this baby came from. I don't know how I got pregnant. I haven't had sex with a man in a really long time. And he says, have you had sex with a woman recently, about 9 months ago? And she's like, yeah, I have had sex with a woman. He's like, oh, well, she must have just had sex with her husband. Some of the semen fell out of her into you. And that's the explanation for that. And there's not this very clear distinction. There's this understanding that both of these women could have had sex with men, and they might have also been having sex with each other.
That is fascinating, Eric. And also, just to ask, what was the language then that people used around sexual orientation? I mean, presumably nobody used the term bisexual, but how would they describe a same-gendered partner?
This is one of the big debates. There's not a lot of terminology that suggests that that was a way people thought about organizing their lives.
Okay.
Like, if you went, and there are certainly examples, there are texts where they talk about where a knight will refuse to have sex with a queen, and the queen is like, I see you, like, you're a boy lover or whatever. You only like to have sex with men. But there isn't really a term. Sodomite is kind of the closest term that we have, but there isn't really a term for, say, people who like to have sex with the same sex, or people who like to have sex with people of different different genders. But there also isn't a term for heterosexuality, right? You couldn't go back into the Middle Ages and say, oh, I'm a heterosexual. Nobody would understand what you meant.
Okay. So people were more, they sort of define themselves more by the acts that they did rather than, right, got it.
Yeah.
Just sitting here fascinated learning about my bi ancestry. and that actually we're miles ahead of them because we've actually got a word for it now. It's interesting.
Or miles behind. I don't know. It depends which way you look at it, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I guess. I guess it's interesting to know that it was still defined by the act, and it was very much... I guess it's hard to look so far back into the past and to know how people felt. And then I guess we can only really judge them on what they acted on and then wrote down about what they were up to. I guess it's such a tricky one to look that far back, I guess.
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, one of the things you were saying earlier was about sort of like the way that they sort of eroticized Christ. And you have all of these instances. I mean, where Christ is like, he's the bridegroom and all good Christians are the bride. And that's both men and women. And they take that really seriously. There are all of these like very erotic accounts by monks who are like, Christ is going to take me to his bedchamber and all of that. And by nuns as well. And so Christ himself is this figure for whom sexuality doesn't seem to be defined in some of these medieval texts by gender. Like, there's no sense that, oh, well, Christ is not going to take a monk to his bedchamber. Of course he's going to, if the monk behaves.
If he's lucky.
Right, yeah. I mean, if you're really holy, that's the reward, supposedly.
Was there also an issue around... We call it today, don't we? Talk about bromances, don't they? In the modern era of the relationship, the connection between straight men, where they hug each other and tactile with each other and all the rest of it.
Homosociality, isn't it? That's what it's called.
Was there some of that going on as well, in the sense that, you know, male bonding side of things? It might not necessarily have ended up in some of the sexual act, but what I'm saying is, what were people more freely... Certainly, men and women, you know, separately, were they more freely able to express their affection for people of the same sex?
Yeah. And again, I'm talking specifically about Western Europe, right? I mean, these things vary so much between languages and cultures throughout the sort of medieval period. But I mean, at least in Western Europe, it was an intensely homosocial culture. I mean, you think of when somebody's knighted, like, he kneels before his lord takes his hands, he kisses him on the cheek. You have all of these ways that the bonds between people are expressed very, very physically. I mean, even much, much earlier, sort of during the period when the Vikings are kind of invading England, you get this poetry by men in the voices of men where there are famous poems about men whose entire villages have been destroyed. And the relationship that they're saddest about is their relationship with their lord, with their king. And they remember how they used to put their head in his lap and he would clasp them and kiss them. And this is the thing that they're really sorrowing about. So you have these incredibly homosocial relations. And that, of course, makes it more difficult because you have men who are sharing the same bed all the time, all of these kinds of things, and sort of separating that out and deciding, okay, well, we're going to call this homosocial, we're going to call this homoerotic, or we're going to call this, you know, some other thing, is really difficult as a historian.
So, Eric, what are you hoping to find out still, if that makes sense? What thing, particularly about sexuality, would really, I don't know, enlighten us now as a society, if you could find it out?
God, this is a really good question. I mean, to some extent, I think what we're still missing is more of a history of common folk, right? Mm. So we know a lot about what people at the top of society did, but we really don't know that much about what ordinary people did. They don't leave us written records. Most of them are illiterate. And for the most part, their experiences aren't recorded. And so we might know, for example, that like Richard the Lionheart is rumored to have had sex with men, but he was also married to a woman. And we know all of this stuff about him, but we don't know what sort of the common peasant necessarily thought about sex. We know what the church thought, we know what bishops thought, but we don't necessarily know what the lower echelons of society thought. And especially, we don't know a lot about women, about sort of women in the lower classes of society. And you don't want to just assume that they thought about it the same way the kings and the knights thought about it. There has to have been folk traditions. There has to have been different cultures about what sex meant. You have to imagine that, I mean, could they all have been what we would call homophobic? I mean, I find that really impossible to believe. Even if it's not spoken about, were there same-sex couples? Were there people who were known for having sex with people of different genders? And we don't know this stuff because so much of the evidence is missing because of the lack of written records.
One of the things that becomes a bit of a taboo when you're talking about bisexuality in the modern era is basically that just the whole idea of bisexuality. A lot of people think. A misconception that bisexuality means that everyone's running around having great orgies all the time and things like that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you know, not everybody who's bisexual is at that, and obviously people are heterosexual and people are homosexual do that as well. But what I'm saying is the whole idea of people having multiple relations all at one time is often seen still today in 2020 as a bit of a taboo. It's something people do behind closed doors and it's all a bit secret. And we can't really talk about it, kind of thing. What is there any evidence that people did that openly and freely in the medieval times?
I had relationships with more than one person at the same time.
Yeah, not necessarily relationships, but maybe sexual encounters, as it were.
Oh yeah, I mean, and there are lots of sort of like bawdy medieval stories about this sort of thing. Boccaccio, for example, very famous late medieval Italian author, has one story where he talks about how a husband who's like very known for mostly preferring men comes home and he finds his wife with a young man who's the wife's lover. And rather than get angry, he proposes that the three of them spend the night together. And we're told that all three of them had a really good time. And so there are these kinds of jokes, right? But so you have to imagine that if that kind of stuff is circulating, you also have you also have actual non-monogamous relationships. You have people who are married for one reason. And again, remember, marriage is a lot of times about property. It's not necessarily about love. Mm. And you have people who have lovers on the side. I mean, we see this all the time. Most of the kings were famous for not being monogamous.
I mean, I say that it's a taboo. Obviously, I'm looking at it in a way from an Anglo perspective. You know, Britain and America and most of the English speaking world has a tendency to see sex as a sort of a dirty word kind of thing. I know that, you know, in certain parts of the world, in France and other parts, even Germany, you know, it isn't seen necessarily in exactly the same way. We all have different varying attitudes of liberal right. or conservative attitudes towards sex. Anything else you want to say, Lewis?
Yeah, I was just going to ask. So you obviously talked about, you know, the censoring in a way sort of came later with not translating things. Was anything destroyed in that period? Like, this must never see the light of day. Let's get rid of it. Or is it just there waiting for you to discover it and waiting for you to translate it?
I'm sure things were destroyed. I mean, there are some manuscripts where parts have been cut out. And a lot of that, I mean, also like in the Reformation, like a lot of Catholic manuscripts were destroyed because they were seen as Catholic and so as having sort of dangerous ideas. I would not be surprised if some stuff has actively been destroyed, but a lot of it has just been forgotten, deliberately or otherwise.
Eric, it's been lovely to chat to you, and hopefully, you know, as you know that we exist as a show, maybe you can keep in touch with us and let us know of anything else that you find out that's interesting and might be interesting to our listeners. But on reflection, what's interesting to me is it just shows, you know, we've all grown up in, I mean, a little bit more better in our times, I suppose. But when you think about the last 100 years, certainly in Britain, of all that sort of repression and everyone sort of having hang-ups over their sexuality, whatever your sexuality is, and you know, all those issues that people have, and you just think to yourself, if we actually were taught about sexuality down the ages, and we knew that these kind of things happened and these kind of things existed, you know, people would be much more open to way people turn out in terms of their identities and things, wouldn't they? I mean, it's such a shame, really, when you think about it.
Oh yeah, and I mean, as a teacher, I perpetually have LGBT students in my classes who are like, I had no idea we had a history that this was long. I had no idea there were trans people in the Middle Ages. I had no idea about any of this kind of stuff. And it's such a shame that we don't know more of this stuff, that this isn't more widely discussed. Yeah. I mean, And often when we assume that when it is discussed, it's discussed in these really specific, they're like, oh, well, they must have all been burned at the stake, blah, blah, blah. But like you have instances, I mean, you have people in the 1300s, you have trials of Eleanor Reichner, for example, who is a sex worker and seemingly a trans woman who had sex with both men and women. And the trial doesn't know how to place her, and they're trying to figure out, they're like, okay, well, do we which pronouns do we use for her? Mm-hmm. Well, how do we talk about this? Is this sodomy? If she's a woman, maybe it's like, and we don't even know that she was ever charged. And so you have all of these like fascinating insights into a culture that was much more complicated. It's as complicated as modern society, and it's a shame we don't see more of that.
I'm just in a reverie now about medieval England, you know. I'm just having a great old time thinking about what was going on.
Maybe we should have an episode where we all dress up.
I think we should, actually. Maybe we can speak in Middle English as well. Yeah, maybe Eric can help us with some wooing words for each other.
It was a really interesting topic. And as the guys know, sometimes I do get a bit put off by the history. But actually, this was quite interesting for me. It's definitely got me thinking about other time periods. You do obviously hear this. You obviously hear about the Greeks and that kind of thing. But medieval you know, medieval England. I hadn't thought about it, so it's interesting.
Yeah,
but of course, I mean, there are queer people throughout history. I mean, it's just that the way we've told the history of it has sort of made them invisible.
Eric, that was wonderful. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us this evening.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, take care.
Brilliant. Take care, Eric.
Bye-bye. Yep.
You're listening to Bisexual Brunch.
Right then, guys, what do we make of that? I mean, that was fascinating, wasn't it, really?
I feel like Nikki lives for history more than me.
She does.
Do you know what, guys? I've surprised myself by what I've remembered on this programme. I actually did some work at university. Who knew?
Like, how many courses did you do? How long were you there for?
Well, you know what's so interesting, though? Because all I ever wrote about was sexuality and literature. That's all I ever wrote about. And then a bit of history throughout my degree. And one of the things that I kept coming upon basically was queer history, but I didn't have the terms for it because we weren't taught it like that. I realized that I was coming across all these characters, and then I was kind of saying, oh, but why are they appropriating female terminology, or why are they using this kind of language? And it was basically medieval queer history that I didn't even know. So that has just blown my mind, that basically I could have wrote a whole different kind of essay every term. But I just found that fascinating. So great.
It is definitely fascinating. I could see you transporting yourself back into that period, Nikki.
Oh, I can't. Ash, I think we should
travel.
I think we should pitch a program about it.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're absolutely right. Well, let's bring things up to date. But when I say up to date, actually it's not, in a way, because various things in the news this week talking about bisexuality, and also some of the comments we've had on the Twitter feed just show that, well, as Lewis was saying, you know, have we progressed or have we regressed? You don't quite know when you're listening to that stuff about the medieval times. Certainly things haven't sort of changed much. You know, somebody sent a message to us saying that they agreed with our conversation, or, well, they reflected on our conversation, I think it was last week, when we were talking about the use of the word sex in bisexual, and saying that actually they were uncomfortable with it because they found that more and more people, whenever they said bisexual, were wanting to know lots of gory details about their sex life and actually couldn't understand just the identity thing. So they decided actually to start calling themselves just literally bi rather than using sex. Mm-hmm. And I just thought to myself, are we really in such a simplistic binary world in which people cannot understand the nuances? I find it very, very, very depressing. And then the other thing was this story of Tinashe. What's her name? Sorry, I'm getting a minute. Have you seen
she's
this?
She's just
one?
Called Tinashe.
Tinashe, oh, she's called Tinashe, yeah. of Tinashe, who came out as bisexual and has realised that actually she feels that it's very difficult to describe herself as bisexual because people misunderstand it all the time and categorise her in different ways that she doesn't want to be categorised by. I find it, I don't know what you guys think, but I just find it really, really, really depressing that this is the state in 2020.
Well, I found it a bit confusing because she did use the phrase of herself, I'm somewhere on the spectrum, which kind of gets you a bit confused with talking about autism. And I couldn't help thinking that somehow, somewhere along the line, she'd almost started using it as a kind of apologetic phrase. Do you know what I mean?
It's
a really weird turn of words, and it's not her fault. It's just that it's the language that she feels is appropriate to describe her situation. But it did feel pretty negative to me, I've got to be honest.
What do you think, Lewis?
Yeah, it's a hard one, and I've come up with this a lot over the years of people saying, you know, I'm, you know, a complicated way of saying bisexual, but I don't want to use the word bisexual, whether that's bi or whether it's, you know, fluid or whatever it is. My personal opinion on the subject is, look, I really don't care about the words you're using to describe yourself, but we have got to have a common consensus here, especially when it comes to people like me that try to do campaigning and activism. It's like, if someone asks you, are you bisexual, in a survey, and they're trying to get to the bottom of mental health issues or sexual transmitted infections and things like that, and you're not saying that you're bisexual, it skewers the research, and it also makes it harder. Like, I know it's so hard nowadays to kind of get the research and get the figures on bisexuality anyway, because so many are closeted. If you then add that the people that are out are also using different terminology, it honestly becomes really tricky to kind of keep track of what's happening and what areas we need to focus on to improve the experience of bi people. So it's kind of a, I have a weird position. I'm like, call yourself what you want, but I need you to call yourself bisexual at certain points, because we need to know what's happening in your experience, so that we can kind of, you know, see if there are things going wrong.
I mean, the bottom line is what we're talking about, isn't it? Whatever you call it, is we're talking about people who are, you know, comfortable and happy to have sexual relations or, you know, relationships with men and women or any gender as a whole. That's what we're talking about. And whether we call it bisexual or fluid or whatever it is, you know, that's what we're talking about. My worry is that because we've got no clarity on that, it makes it harder for people who are bisexual or fluid or whatever to be accepted still, because everyone thinks of straight and gay, and they don't think of anything in between. And if there is something in between, you know, you're just experimenting, or you're not quite making your mind up, or whatever it is. And until we can get beyond that, you know, there's going to be so many problems for people, and those problems are going to continue.
The thing that annoys me, Ash, is that I feel that bisexual people carry the can for everybody who doesn't like labels. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, nobody says that to gay people or lesbian people. Oh, you shouldn't label yourself. But they do say it to bi people all the time, especially people who are more conservative. And I find it really irritating that in the culture wars, it's lefty bisexuals that are the most, you know, troublesome category in a way, because they're trying to force this term that other people don't want them to use.
Yeah, I mean, in the gay world, it's this whole thing of that they've got to a point now where whether they want to own those words and the identity,
right,
don't they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we still haven't got there. We still don't have the right kind of movement of people, or, I don't know, political identity or whatever it is, but we're not there yet.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's, I don't know, I mean, hopefully, you know, things will change. I mean, more and more people are coming out. There's this story about this British boxer who's become the first with a same-sex dance debut on, is it Strictly Come Dancing?
Yeah, Nicola Adams.
Fabulous that, you know, we've got that. But it'd be interesting to see how she's referred to on that show. How often will she be referred to as bisexual?
Yes.
You know.
I am so... And I think she's in a relationship with a woman as well, which is going to make things confusing for some people, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm
this
so...
This is always
I'm
what you
so
have to
intrigued.
Watch the media with.
Yeah. I'm so intrigued to see how she's going to be talked about, how the relationship's going to be represented, what they're going to say about the coupling. Are people who are gay just going to claim it as a win for them? You know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, I don't know where we're going with it, but the media is I mean, it's interesting actually, because I have noticed, I don't know if there's anything to do with our show or not, but I have noticed the odd little extra bit appearing in the mainstream media about bisexuality. It feels that people are, it does seem to be a slight movement that people, whether it's because more people are actually openly stating they are bisexual and are gradually becoming comfortable, I don't know. But I still think we're a long way from it being, you know, it's sort of shouted from the rooftops, really.
Yeah. We're still a long way. And I like what you guys were saying about, you know, the gay people will try and claim it, because I've definitely seen that over the years where someone will come out as bi and it's like, no, it's the first gay this. And it's like, no, they didn't say that, though. Like, I took to task a few years ago, Paddy Power. They did like a pride bus at Brighton Pride. And it was like the first, I think the bus was called something like Out Gay Premier League Footballers. And the idea was they had no one on it to kind of like say like, oh, there's no out gay footballers. And I was like, what about the bisexual ones? And that's always my thing, that I think what will happen with this country is, you know, maybe the first out player will be bisexual, but they will be claimed as gay.
Yeah.
Especially if they've got a same-sex relationship. And they will use those things. Like, oh, well, why do you need to label? Just use our label. You know what I mean? And I think it is something we have to watch with this. And it's weird because you do have bisexual people themselves that do feel uncomfortable. They're put off from using the label. It's something we have to really make people feel comfortable with using the word.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, in future weeks, we're going to be talking about all sorts of different things. Hopefully next week. Which I don't think you're going to be around next week, are you, Nikki, for next week's show?
No, I'm sunning myself in Crete with a bit of luck. So I'll leave you guys to it.
Next week we're actually...
A Bi Boys episode.
Absolutely, a Bi Boys. Well, in fact it is, because we're going to be talking to a guy who's been doing research specifically into bi male relationships, or bi relationships, you know, involving men, basically. And he's been talking about not just them and their perspective, but their partner's perspectives as well. So we're going to hear a little bit more about that. And we also, hopefully, maybe next week, maybe the week after, we're going to be focusing on a little bit on bisexuality in Northern Ireland. So there's lots coming up in the next few weeks. Have a good holiday, Nikki.
Thanks. I will do. I won't think about you at all.
Well, I think you should do some. I think you should do some. If you're sunning yourself.
Oh my God, I'm going to send you those stickers.
Oh,
go crazy over
there.
Oh
my gosh.
Get arrested abroad doing the sticker.
Oh God, no, because I don't want to be used as a bargaining chip by the British government for something.
Can you imagine?
Because I'm so important, obviously.
It would be great for the show, though.
It would be great for the show. I'll do it for the show, guys. I'll do it for the show.
I've got an impression of you now. Now you've got this sort of this history bug in you again. I've got the impression of you just sat there all the holiday reading historical pieces about sexuality.
That's mainly what I do, Ash. My library at home is mainly made up of those books. I can't wait for a new sexual historical book to come out. And also, I'm going to be salivating over all the old monuments and statues and things, and hopefully there'll be some sapphic ones keep me occupied.
Fabulous. Okay, good stuff, guys. Well, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, Nikki, and Lewis and I will be back next week. Okay, well, that's Bisexual Brunch for this week.
If you've got any comments, thoughts, musings, do get in touch with us at Bisexual Brunch on Twitter.
And thank you for listening, and we'll see you later.
Bye for now.
Guys, you do realise I had to go into the wardrobe to get the sound quality for this. Like, I've literally had to go back into the closet. The irony.
This programme is an MIM production. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.